Okay, thank you as always, and thank you as always to the shul for hosting the Center of Beit Midrash, and for those of you who have generously helped make the Center of Modern Torah Leadership as a year-round venture viable this year. There's always a risk when talking about issues of conversion in a practical sense, because if you raise the possibility that something yields the result, that a conversion that is done in any kind of standard fashion is invalid, so you probably violate Yisurim Deoraisa about being verbally cruel to converts. So I want to say at the outset that while we're talking about an issue that is being very pressingly debated on a practical level, and I'll talk about my own history and contemporary involvement with the issue, but I'm going to say up front that my own position is that there should be no question that conversions done in which the, particularly conversions of women in which the Beit Din does not visually observe the actual immersion, are valid. At the end of it, we can take questions about what the various models about. I want to say that up front so that at least my own presentation shouldn't raise the question that I'm challenging the validity of the conversion of anyone who went in good faith through an Orthodox conversion. My own interest in this actually stems from an issue like that some years ago, when the RCA began to standardize its own system, it was told to me, and I believe this was true, that there were certain poskim in the RCA who did not take the same position I did, but who were willing to retroactively question conversions that were done in good faith because of the mechanism by which the Beit Din served to be at the mikveh. And that's one of the reasons that the Boston Beit Din is not part of the GPS system, is because I think my colleagues were not willing to become part of a system which formally engaged in that practice. Now, GPS is the RCA standard centralized conversion system. So while it happens the Boston Beit Din on its own formulated print guidelines that are roughly identical to those of the GPS system, which is why we function mutual respect and interchangeability. But that's one of the issues that really bothered me, was that the way the GPS system is currently constructed, and many of you know that the RCA put out a report yesterday which suggested redoing it, and this is one of the issues that it suggested redoing, which was something that we fought for at the very beginning, was to determine exactly the parameters of the discretion of local Batei Din on some of these issues, and secondly, to work out what the parameters of acceptability are in terms of the immersion of female converts. But for now, as set up, to belong to the GPS system meant that you could not certify conversions that had been done in the past in a manner not consistent with current GPS guidelines. And while we were perfectly happy to live with the GPS guidelines going forward, we didn't think, and I think generally it's a very, very bad idea to try and impose halakha retrospectively where people who acted in good faith would pay the price. So I want to state that up front. Now, having fought that fight, and I should say this is a topic that leads, I think, to both a lot of heat and a lot of light, and certainly I will state in my case that there was certainly heat. So I argued with one of my teachers, who was one of the people who took that, and I argued quite vociferously with him about the issue. I don't think I changed his mind, but I think, and I'm told that in practice the GPS system will probably not actually enforce that, but they won't guarantee it either. The background was of getting involved in on a purely practical level. Then at some point I read an article by Rabbanit Michal Tikuchinsky, who is the head of the Women's Beit Midrash and Beit Morashah in Yerushalayim, in which she went through the sugya comprehensively in an attempt to argue that the standard practice should be that a Beit Din should not be present when female converts immerse, or at least not be present in the room. And her article, as often happens because I'm a contrarian, had exactly the wrong impact on me. Before I read her article, I thought, well, it's obvious that nobody would think that this could possibly be invalid b'diavad. The only issue could be whether you should do this l'chatchila. And I came out of the article convinced, no, really, there are Rishonim, lots of Rishonim, who think that it's invalid b'diavad. So it had exactly the wrong impact on me. I actually told her this when I met her last year. it's more like a year and a half ago, I said, you know, I read your article, and for the life of me, I don't understand the nature of your argument, because your argument seems to be, as I take it, that there are a number of Rishonim who think this is Pasul even B'diavad, that the conversion is wholly invalid, and some Rishonim who say that it's kosher, and you think that because you really like the practice better, we should follow the positions that say that it's kosher. But I couldn't imagine that anybody would in fact adopt a practice knowing in advance that there were significant Rishonim who held it was Pasul B'diavad. That seemed to me wholly out of the realm of halachic reality and the environment as is, and furthermore, it might even be, if you did that in the United States, I think it's legitimately can be called rabbinic malpractice, because you're setting somebody up for a later question. Now, her response was extremely revealing to me about a whole set of issues. What she said is, I don't understand the issue. The rabbinut will accept, right? Once the rabbinut accepts it, everyone will have to go along. And that's like a whole different vision of the way in which halakha functions, right? Where really it does endorse a centralized authority, and you want a centralized authority with great power, that so long, right? So long as you can win an argument in your central legislature, then what else, why should anything else matter? And that's really a very profound illustration, both of the gap between the way in which Israeli, even Dati Lumi Israelis, conceive of the way halakha ought to function, and the way in which American modern Orthodox do, because we're all about autonomy and let a thousand flowers bloom, some of us, and some of us want that centralized thing around various Wayu Rashi Yeshiva, say. But I think that there's a big movement in modern Orthodoxy to think about, in principle, autonomy and pluralism are good ideas, and it played out the cost. The cost of that is, when you have pluralism, you often have a need for consensus. And when you have a centralized system, you can have power. So that was a really interesting question. That was her answer. I still find it hard to imagine that first of all, the Rabbanut doesn't really, isn't universally accepted even in Israel. It's not accepted by Haredim. So I asked another prominent Dati Lumi rabbi about that. Like, why don't you care about Haredi acceptance of conversions? And he said, because it's much easier for me to imagine my daughter marrying a Chiloni than a Haredi. Our communities are so socially distinct that they don't intermarry anymore, so why would we care about mutual intermarriageability? And that's also like a wholly radical difference between Israeli and American experiences. So I want to put that on the table first. That's how I first got into this. So yeah, it was first with the GPS system where I thought we should not join because somebody had to be able to issue Ishurim for women who converted that way and validate their conversions in a way that would be broadly accepted. And that we should not be party to changing the rules retrospectively on people who acted in good faith. Then I read the article and I felt less good about myself. Then sometime for the past year, after the Rabbi Freundel scandal, although there obviously was no direct connection, but at that time, Rabbi Shmuel Hertzfeld in Washington sent a question to Rabbi Jeffrey Fox, who is the Rosh Hashiva Yeshivat Maharat, saying that the women in the conversion program that he was engaged in had, in the aftermath of Rabbi Freundel, expressed deep discomfort about a practice of actually going to the mikvah in front of the Beit Din, and would he allow them to lichatchila, enact the practice of not having the Beit Din present in some fashion? And Rabbi Fox wrote and published a tshuva on the subject, which he sent me shortly in advance. I didn't have time to read it before he published it. Since then, we've actually spent several hours actually together discussing it. And so I'll leave his tshuva aside because we're in private correspondence. After that, Rabbi Saskar Katz of Yeshivat Chovei Torah wrote a concurring opinion, which I think is simply wrong. And I told Rabbi Katz immediately, and I told him publicly, that I think he should retract. I think it's simply an error. We may have a chance to talk about why that is today. And I was all ready to write my own intellectual piece about it. I thought I'd done all the massive research, and I devoted lots and lots of time to it. You can't hear me? I devoted lots and lots of time to it. And as I was about to thought I could put out a really good article on it, Rabbi Yonatan Rosenzweig in Israel put out a massively researched piece that showed that I had completely missed a whole bunch of Rishonim on a sugya that I knew was a parallel sugya, but I hadn't looked at the Rishonim on that sugya comprehensively, and so there went several weeks of effort. And I had to start over again. Harry Rosenzweig also reached the conclusion that advocating that the standard practice should be for Beit Din not actually to be present in the room for the conversion. And while I also disagree with him, the research was extremely impressive, and so we disagree. It doesn't mean that he's wrong. That doesn't mean that he made an error. We disagree. Since then, I have also taught a web yeshiva class on the subject, in addition to giving this as a lecture to several groups of old students. All those, though, I have always done it from. I was trying to figure out intellectually how the sugya developed. Right? What do I think was the halakha in time of the Gemara? What do I think was the halakha in the time of the Gaonim? How did that develop through the Rishonim up until the Shulchan Aruch? And I didn't really talk about what the halakha should be nowadays. Because I thought that first I should really, really understand what was happening before I even got to the question of how to talk about it nowadays. And often I did it the way I often teach halakha, as my masorah from my chavruta, the name of Rabbi Kellermer, the name of the Rav, is that one way to think of the Rav's Psak is you have to realize that the Shulchan Aruch never happened. And if we just go on, the Shulchan Aruch is a bottleneck where lots of positions get weeded out and other positions get concretized. And you can just imagine, the Shulchan Aruch is your first source, but once you have a time to do the sugya independently, so in some areas, Rabbi Kellermer said, I'm told by my chavruta, that the best way to understand how the Rav Paskind is that the Shulchan Aruch never happened. And we're still going back to doing Rishonim. And that's often the way I learn. Conversion specifically, that seems to me a risky way to Paskin Halakha because of the need to gather some kind of consensus. So as we talk about, what I want to do today is give you a window to some extent into what the Halakha is following the Shulchan Aruch, how you figure out what the Shulchan Aruch means, and whether that should really be the be-all and end-all of how Halakha functions. I should say one other thing that that came up in the course of this, and that'll be a transition to, I guess we'll try and put in some intellectual candy at the very beginning of the presentation before we do some drier stuff. So Rabbi Ezra Schwartz, who is a wonderful Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan, gave a shir in which he raised his own objection to the issue. I don't know if I don't know which tshuva specifically he was responding to, whether it was possibly Rabbi Katz. It's not the same objection I did. And it was really a beautiful objection that made me happy for quite some time, but I was quite sure it was wrong. The reason I was quite sure it was wrong is that he introduced a source that although Rav Avad Yosef has a very strong tshuva on this subject in which he objects to the practice of not having the Beit Din present, and Rav Moshe has several tshuvot on the subject, and there are other attempts at comprehensive treatments. Not one of those treatments had ever mentioned the fairly straightforward, a Mishnah Berurah that Rabbi Schwartz had cited. So I was quite sure it had to be wrong because because if he were right, then all these great people had overlooked a really, really obvious source. But I had a great deal of pleasure reading it and figuring out why it was wrong. So I think it's wrong. But it's still really beautiful. Unfortunately, we don't have a chance. We probably won't have a chance to do it tonight. So now I want to give you an example of what kind of arguments work and what kind of arguments don't work halachically. And that very much depends on what methodology you're in. So here is what I think is far and away, next to Rabbi Schwartz, maybe even after ahead of Rabbi Schwartz, the coolest thing anyone has ever done with this circuit. The coolest thing comes from Rabbi Shlomo Kluger. Rabbi Shlomo Kluger lived in the late 19th, early 20th century. Is the author of, among others, Ha'elef Lecha Shlomo, which is a collection of 1,000 tshuvot, and that you recognize that is only one of his works. You understand he wrote a lot. He wrote a lot, and he was brilliant. If you lived in the Yeshiva Har Etzion world, this is one of the great debates between Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and Rav Amital, that Rav Amital loved paskening like Rav Shlomo Kluger, and Rav Lichtenstein thought that was just nuts. So I will tell you, I think, I get caught betwixt and between, and that I think it's beautiful, but the paskin like it feels a little bit nuts. But I've taught it several times already, and if I teach it, people keep telling me, what's crazy about that? So I'll tell it to you, and maybe you'll fall in love with it, and that will end the whole conversation. So here's the data I want you, here's the data. Okay, we'll get back to this data in a moment, but I'm going to give you the data in purely raw terms. The data in purely raw terms is, Generally, let's assume that in order for a conversion to work, there has to be a Beit Din at the mikveh. That's a given. Men, women, all, that's a given. Second piece of data is, however, if a non-Jewish woman goes to mikveh with the intent of becoming tohara after her nida period, she has converted, even though no one was there. Now, how do you square these two things? How can, on the one hand, there must be a Beit Din present, that's the rule. And on the other hand, you go to mikveh for nida, poof, you're a Jew. So Rav Shlomo Kluger does it as follows. He says, first of all, there is a Gemara that says that ordinarily, a tzurah ha-petach, the frame of a doorway, counts as a wall for the purposes of Shabbat, but not for the purposes of Sukkot. Right, so you can have a wholly enclosed space for Shabbat, like an Erev, right? But you cannot take giant bamboo sticks and put them all over the right, and put them all over Sharon, right, where the Erev is, and say, poof, that's a sukkah. Right, for a sukkah, you actually have to have 2.5 walls. Ah, except on Shabbat. On Shabbat, you can use a Tzurat HaPetach as a wall, because since it counts for Shabbat, it also counts for Sukkot. So says Rav Shlomo Kluger, so ordinarily you need a Beit Din in order for an immersion to count. But since it counts for Nida, it also counts for conversion.
Only when you're doing it for Nida.
Yes, when you do it for Nida. So it works for conversion. Okay, that's only step one. Yes, lots of you have a question about this? Yeah, Toby, yes.
So how does it Tzurat HaPetach count for Sukkah and Shabbos?
Because since it's already a wall halachically, it's serving a purpose halachically.
It's okay to make the of a sukkah if you're eating within the roof and not outside of a sukkah.
If it has a roof. You still need a roof.
Wait, so if all of the walls of your sukkah fall down?
No, but the roof has to be connected to the walls. But you could theoretically build your sukkah just out of...
the canvas comes down, but you have the
Yeah, so it might be that on Shabbat, that'd be fine.
Yeah. Does anyone ask it this way?
I don't know. Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Look it up. Yeah, solution. Yes, you do? Mm-hmm. Do you know if anyone buskers that way?
I mean, I don't think anyone actually do it.
Yes, Alicia. Does
neither apply to non-Jews?
But then it probably says, hang on a sec. This doesn't work at all. Because you can't go to mikveh for Nida as a non-Jew.
About two entire
right. The whole thing doesn't apply to non-Jews. So it doesn't work at all. You can't go to mikveh in order to make it work for Nida as a non-Jew, because you can't go, right? This is really a problem. But it's not an insoluble problem. It's not an insoluble problem because we have another Gemara. Another Gemara says that the way in which you free a Canaanite slave is you hand them a document, and they acquire the document, and once they acquire the document, they're free. The problem is, Canaanite slaves can't acquire things. Catch 22. We don't like catch 22s. So we say that the acquisition of the document and the freedom of the slave happen one after the other at the same time. When I was in my second year in NYU, I was interviewed at Parnas this year. We spent many, many weeks debating whether this is an example of simultaneous consecutivity or consecutive simultaneity. You can decide for yourself which of these, right? Which of these best describes it? But there were lots of documents. <right? laughs> Any case, right? Whichever one of those you prefer, you have to define the terms though first before you get the nafkamina. It turns out, so we have this example in halacha of things that happen one after another at the same time. In other words, two things cause each other. And even though each of them requires the other to happen first, that's okay. So Shlomo Kluger says, "Oh look, right? She's Jewish, so that means she went to mikveh for Nida. She went to mikveh for Nida, so she's Jewish. Poof. Okay, that's Shlomo Kluger's solution. Now, who can decide to be paskin that way? Because this is so obviously brilliant that there's no way that without divine inspiration, anybody could possibly have thought of that. Or you could say, what? You take two of the most implausible ideas in all of halacha." And you, so I should say, when I taught this on Web Yeshiva, my, uh, my friend Dov Weinstein pointed out, these are not the, right, that actually there are other cases where we apply consecutive simultaneity. So it's not totally out of the world, out of this world. It still strikes me as weird.
He's missing a step, though.
Pardon?
He's missing a step.
What is he missing?
She has to become Anita also. When does that happen?
Ah, that's an interesting question.
No, she's doing it before her wedding, right?
No, we're not talking about the sugya. He's not talking, right? Interesting question. If we solve the other two, we can solve that one. Yes, we can. Yes, Roger.
When a woman goes to convert, is she allowed to convert during her menstrual cycle?
Yes. We prefer not to, but it doesn't invalidate the conversion. Yes, Roger.
So I'm assuming that the question we're talking about is that comes from the Gemara and Yibama Stop Rame.
Yeah, we'll get there. Very good.
Is this the only way to understand that Gemara?
Oh, no. Okay. No, there are many, many ways to understand that Gemara, but none of them are anywhere near as much fun. Yes, Tova.
So Yisha's problem isn't that there's a chazakah that she's Anida. So the moment that she converts, she becomes Jewish and Anida.
And Anida. Right. The question is, can he become Nida and Anida simultaneously?
I don't think that's crazier than anything we just
said. As they say, I'm not. So you can decide. I say people have very different reactions. Very, very different reactions to I often tell people that my best Purim Torah ever turned out to be a straight Rav Lachan Wasserman. So you never know. You never know. Sometimes you think you're okay. That's not how we're gonna paskal. All right, today. So what I want to do is, very unusually for me, I want to start with the Shulchan Aruch, and let's see what the Shulchan Aruch says, and then let's see why the Shulchan Aruch says what he says, and let's see where we can go from there. Okay, so if you look at the Shulchan Aruch and the, there's a background in Hebrew, we don't really need that. Background in Hebrew just tells you, you know what, we're giving you the basic outline of conversion, and the standard outline of conversion is Kabbalah HaMitzvot, and then if you're male, circumcision and immersion, and the circumcision should come first, but b'diavad it works if the immersion comes before the circumcision. Okay, so now here we have, right, so after the circumcision, therefore, you wait until he heals, and then you immerse him. Okay, so now we go to A. So A says, and three, and the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, right, says the three should be scholars, stand next to the convert, and they inform him of some light and some heavy mitzvot for the second time, while he v'hu omeid b'mayim, while he stands in the water. Okay, so that now we're in the standard male, right? The standard male thing is the convert is in the water. There are three scholars standing al gabav, right, near him, next to him, over him, and they inform him of the mitzvot. Right now, the next thing is he should immerse, but we have a break. What if the convert isn't male? What if the convert is female? So this is B. If the convert is a woman, then women place her in the water up to her neck. Okay, so I don't know how the man got in the water, but for the woman there are women assisting her, and they put her in the water up to her neck. V'adayanim mibachutz, and the judges are outside. This has caused, I think, Rabbi Josh Uter has a whole long thing trying to figure out what would it mean for judges to be outside if in this culture most mikvahs were outdoors. So that's a whole interesting question, right? What is the realia of a world in which judges are mibachutz? But let's assume that we're naive, we don't know anything about history, and so we have a mikvah like ours, and the judges are outside. Umodin otam miksat mitzvah kalot v'chamurot, and they inform her of some light and some heavy mitzvot. V'hi yoshevet b'mayim. Right, so the man was standing in the water, and she is sitting in the water, presumably up to her neck. Okay, and then the Shulchan Aruch is very explicit. V'achar kach tovelet bifnehem. Afterwards, she immerses, and the term it uses is bifnehem. Right. Pardon?
In their presence.
Might be a translation. I'm going to try to avoid translating until the very end. V'hei machazirim pnehem, and they turn their faces aside. When do they turn their faces aside? Before or after?
After.
Probably right after, although it could be that she immerses bifnehem while they are immersing their faces. But then it says, Kadesh l'yiru ota kishita'aleh me'amayim, so they won't see her when she comes out of the water. Okay, so we have three sections. A, there are three scholars standing over the man. B, if it's a woman, the judges are external. and C is, but nonetheless, she immerses bifnehem, and they turn their faces aside. Okay, and then once the immersion happens, then the convert is Jewish, meaning that their marriages are valid even if they cease to be observant or even cease to identify as Jews. Okay, that is the Shulchan Aruch's description of the standard conversion process. It doesn't tell you what is ma'akev b'dieved, what's necessary. It only tells you this is how it should be done as your default setting. Okay, yes, Ellie?
It's just mashma from the word atzorara that like we are sensitive to her themes.
Oh yeah, we certainly are sensitive, right? We explicitly this is the male process and this is the female process. Why? Because there are tzniut issues. No question. Whether we're sensitive enough, we can judge. But there's no question. We're not ignoring the issue. Okay, let me go to D. D says all matters of the kind. Right now we move from the description of the standard process. Now we move to the normative thing. What must happen? So all matters of a convert, whether to inform of the mitzvah, whether the circumcision or the immersion, have to be with three who are valid to judge. And during the day. Okay, that's right. That's our first normative statement. But E, that only applies to chachila. But b'diavad, if the circumcision or the immersion happens only before two, or even if the judges who are present are relatives of each other or the convert, and at night, even if the conversion was not done for the sake of conversion, but rather for the sake of keri or nida, right? In all these cases, havi ger umutra b'Yisraelit, right? You are a convert and you are permitted to marry a Jew, except for kabbalat hamitzvot that has to be during the day. And with three. So the first position of Shulchan Aruch cites clearly says that while lichatchila we want a beit din to be present at the immersion, but b'diavad, if there is no beit din present, it might be that you require two valid witnesses, it might be that you require nobody, it might be that it depends, but there's no question that a beit din is not necessary at the conversion b'diavad, according to the first position of Shulchan Aruch. Okay, but then he says, now we're in F. We'll riff the Harambam, but according to Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi and the Rambam, the great Sephardi, early medieval Sephardi postgame, Afila b'diavad shetaval omal b'tnei shtayim ubalayla me'akev v'asur b'Yisraelit. But according to the riff of the Rambam, this is not true. If you immerse not in the presence of a beit din, you are right, that prevents the conversion from taking effect, and you are not allowed to marry a Jew. Okay, so now we have a very straightforward machloket between between the first position of the Shulchan Aruch and the Rif and the Rambam on the other hand. The first position says it works b'diavad, the second position says it doesn't work b'diavad. And that would be great, except the Shulchan Aruch throws in the weirdest line. The last line he says in F is, Aval im nasa Yisraelit v'holid mimena ben, but if he goes ahead and marries a Jewish woman and has a child, lo pasli nanle, we don't invalidate the child. So why would you invalidate? Why would you invalidate the child? So that relates to a broader question about what the status of patrilineals is. But the bigger question is, even though he only says it from the male perspective, the simplest reading of the Shulchan Aruch is that this works for both men and women. And therefore, if a woman, what he's saying is, even according to the Rif and Rambam, if you go to mikveh not in front of Beit Din, so the conversion doesn't work. You're not allowed to marry a Jew. But if you go ahead and marry a Jew, your child is Jewish. Good, because otherwise, right, so you think you don't invalidate him if he's had a child?
The whole topic is about invalidating a convert.
Yeah, but then it says, but if Velid me met a ben, so what does it matter if he had a child if the issue is the convert?
Because once there's a father and once there's a family involved, then you don't want to try to...
And what's the status of the kid?
Well, technically he's Jewish because his mother was Jewish.
So again, you're assuming this only works the male way, but it seems to me the most likely reading of it is, right, so he doesn't make any distinction between men and women.
But why would
So patrilineals, right? The standard halacha, which we don't paskin this way, but the evidence nowadays is that they can't marry kohanim. Patrilineals, standard halacha, matrilineals, right? Women, people who are whose mothers are Jewish and fathers are not. On the male side, probably means can marry a Kohen, and on the female side means, right, they're Jewish. Okay.
Do we know what the Rift hold, hold about Evavak and Baal Vestral?
Good, have to look that up. Okay. Then he has line G, who says, oh, by the way, this seems repetitive, as because we already saw this in D. He says, since the conversion of the convert requires a Beitin of three, you can't do it at night or in Yontif, or, you can't do it on Shabbos or in Yontif at night, but if you immerse, then in fact you are a convert, so he seems to go back to Tosfot. Although he doesn't mention anything, he says, since it requires three, you can't do it during these times, but then in the end he says, right, but if you do it during those times, okay, he never tells you really what the halakha is if you do it not in front of the Beit Din, and there are ways to distinguish. Okay, so this is the Shulchan Aruch, right, but he presents it as if there are only two positions, right, and those two positions are, one is a perfectly ordinary position that it works b'di'evid but not l'chatchila, and the other is an odd position that it doesn't work even b'di'evid, unless it's really, really b'di'evid. Right, so, right, there's no circumstances that would compel the Beit Din to do it. And even if a Beit Din has done it in error, or if he did it by himself, that would not, right, that wouldn't count. But if he gets so far as to get a Jewish, right, or she gets so far as to engage in a marriage and they have a kid, we don't take it out on the kid. Which sounds like everybody agrees it really, really works at some level. Right? But you don't really, really, really need a Beit Din. And the only argument is about how far we impose this lechatchila din that you should have a Beit Din. Right? That's a plausible reading of the Shulchan Aruch, that there should be, right, there are only two positions. Both positions agree you shouldn't do it lechatchila, and that it works b'diavad, but they debate about what b'diavad means. One b'diavad just means like everything else. Once it happens, and the other says b'diavad means that you actually went to you actually had a child. And even then, we only let it count for the child and possibly not for you. Yes. Okay.
That's
yes. Yes, Miriam.
Like if not two people, does that mean actually two people or just like not a Beit Din? So we don't.
Good question. So that's a machloket, and it might be two people now that just means less than three, and right we can go down to one or zero. It might be specifically two people. It might be it depends on whether they were previously known to be not Jewish. Okay. Yes, Gina.
Is there any way that you can read the Shulchan Aruch saying it seems very implausible that if we're talking about a woman that they would have allowed, or just from the Shulchan Aruch that they would have allowed a woman, is it possible that if B'diyah that he married, it's saying that if he married a Jewish woman and they had a child, then he becomes retroactively a ger?
How?
Because they had a child where they decided to include that.
Okay, but still, any time you say he becomes a ger, retroactively, we really mean is he was always a ger. Just we imposed some kind of derabanan restriction that didn't allow, which is a very odd thing to do. Right? People say, right, how can you do that? Right, he has mitzvot. Right, you're going to tell him that he can't do. Right, now this is sometimes you tell people, no, stop, you can't do mitzvot. I remember, you know, one of the questions that came up once where. Rav Moshe has a tshuva that seems to suggest that you can't give an aliyah to a heretic because the heretic's brachos are brachot levatala. And so one of my colleagues asked this question to Rav Tversky, Alav HaShalom. Rav Tversky said, what, if he eats an apple, you'll tell him, no, it's usher to make a bracha?
Rav Moshe says that perish in tshuva.
Which one, the first one or the second one?
The second one, eating food.
Yes, so Rav Tversky thought that that was a contradiction.
Is there
a question that he shouldn't make the bracha?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Rav Tversky thought that was absurd. So I was told. I just can't imagine. And part of it is different impressions about, you know, even what a quote-unquote Mumer Lahakis is nowadays, I suspect. Okay. So, where did the Shulchan Aruch get these from? So I want to try and show you what the Shulchan Aruch is, first of all. Where does he get this from? So I sent you on the next page to the tour. And what you'll see is that the Shulchan Aruch is relatively close to word for word taken from the tour, except that line C and line G are not in the tour. Line G doesn't matter to us right now so much, but line C really matters because line C said that afterwards she has to immerse Bifnehem. And if you leave out line C, right, then he never tells you what is supposed to happen after the judges, right? The judges are outside. They inform her of the mitzvot. And then what happens? So line C is critical, because line C tells you that she has to be tovil bifnehem, and line C is not in the Torah. Where does it come from? It comes from the Rambam, which is on the bottom of the page. Right? The Rambam has exactly that line. And line G is also from, right, is also from the Rambam. So if you want to know what the Shulchan Aruch is doing, what the Shulchan Aruch is doing is he starts with the Torah, and he cuts and pastes, essentially, right, from the Rambam. That's right. That's the basic framework. Yes.
Does it never say what a man does when he actually immerses?
Nope.
It talks about him standing, and they tell him about the exposure. It talks about a woman standing, they tell him, and then the immersion is being had. But in the man, it doesn't get to that.
That's right. But the judges are there anyway, right? The judges are standing over him. So when he immerses, right, the judges are still there.
But you're assuming that.
That's true.
They could also walk out.
They could also have walked out, right? That right? It doesn't say that. I would say Kal v'chomer, if you say that the woman has to immerse bifnehem, then probably the man has to immerse bifnehem also, I would think. Okay. So what we have in, right, the Shulchan Aruch is he has the Torah in front of him. He copies almost word for word, except that he's bothered that the Torah leaves out what the woman has to do. So he puts in that the woman has to immerse in front of the Beit Din from the Rambam. Okay, but there's one other, right, so now we've solved the basic differences between the Torah and the Rambam. We don't know what the Torah held about that. Right? Now we recognize we don't know what the Torah said the woman has to do. But I want to point out one other thing. That, remember, the Shulchan Aruch said the position that it's okay b'diavad is the position is position A. Then he says, but for the Rif and the Rambam, it's not that way. But if you look at the Torah says, but for the Rif it's not that way. And says nothing about the Rambam. Right, this is the very beginning of F. Right, in the Shulchan Aruch it says Ula Harif Ula Rambam, and in the Torah it just says Ula Rav Alfas. Now, why is that? Why is that? Because the Torah certainly had the Rambam. Right, so he certainly knew about the Rambam. Right, he certainly knew about the Rambam's position. So why does the Torah say that it's the Why does the Torah say that it's the position only of the Rif? And the Beis Yosef says it's the position of the Rif and the Rambam. So the only way we can resolve that is by looking at the Beit Yosef. Right? The Beit Yosef is the index cards for the Shulchan Aruch. Right? First, you take all the medieval positions, you write them down on index cards, and then you digest them into the Shulchan Aruch. So if you want to know what the Rav Yosef Kara had in front of him, right, to create the Shulchan Aruch, we can look at this. So we know he had the Torah in front of him. We know he had the Rambam in front of him. What else did he have in front of him? So if you look at the next page, it's the Beit Yosef, it will turn out that what he has in front of him, and really all he has in front of him that we can tell is he has the Rif, he has the Rambam, and he has a medieval commentary on the Rambam called the Magid Mishnah. And essentially, if you look at the Beit Yosef, what he does is he essentially just rearranges the Magid Mishnah. The Magid Mishnah is a commentary on the Rambam, so the Magid Mishnah goes as follows. The Rambam says this. Oh, that means, right, that means this. Oh, look, the Rif sounds just like that. By the way, the Ramban said something. Beis Yosef says the Rambam said this, and the Magid Mishnah says the Rambam meant that, and oh, by the way, that sounds very much like the Rif. Or actually says, no, the Rif said this, and the Rambam said this, and the Magid Mishnah interprets the Rambam like that, which makes it sound just like the Rif. And by the way, the Ramban said something. Okay, so if you want to know how the Shulchan Aruch happened, we pretty much know how the Shulchan Aruch happened. The way the Shulchan Aruch happened is, he starts with the Torah, he supplements the Torah with the Rambam, and his interpretation of the Rambam is generated by the Magid Mishnah, and the Magid Mishnah, in his citation of the Rambam also quotes the Ramban. All right, so basically, all the Beis Yosef has in front of him that we know of that matters to him is a Rif, a Rambam, the Magid Mishnah explaining the Rambam, and the Ramban. Okay, that's all the information in front of us, and it seems now we have to try and figure out so. the first position, right? So the first position he doesn't cite, but the first position, sorry, actually, the first position is Tosfot. So yeah, right, I didn't give you that. But the first position is Tosfot, and that'll be perfectly clear. But the position that he cites, the name of the Rif and the Rambam, what he has is the Rif, the Rambam, the Magid, Mishnah, and the Ramban. Now remember, the position he cited from the Rif and the Rambam was weird. Right? It's a claim that it worked. The conversion really works, but not for you, only for your kid. Yes, Roger.
I'm reading ahead a little bit.
Yes.
It seems like both the Beit Yosef and the Magid Mishnah, they're not so much saying that the dipping for the needle or carry what is.
Yeah. Don't, not yet. Not yet. Okay, very good. Not yet. Shouldn't have read ahead yet.
Right.
It's fine you did, but I don't want to take that question yet. Yes.
I mean, the question, like, I wonder if the conversion of the kid comes from Mikayach B'diavad, or really, like, as you're seeing Yavamas, the fact that a woman has a power to be a guy or a child. So it maybe it's the koach conversion, not the koach.
She can't convert herself. How can she convert her child?
The same thing where she said that she converted her 3-year-old.
What if it's the father?
That Haldas Bezdin. You still need Haldas Bezdin.
What if it's the man also?
You still need a Bezdin to immerse the kid. There's no Bezdin, no mikveh. Nobody, right? You can't, right? She can dunk her kid privately, she can dunk herself privately. Can't convert your kid more than you convert yourself.
No, I'm just saying that it's the power of the conversion, not the power of the b'diavad. Like,
no, you can't do it. Either you convert yourself or not. And when did she never took her kid to mikveh? The kid was just born. Right? A non-Jewish woman can't convert her kid in the womb just by saying so. I want my kid to be Jewish. He has to go to mikveh in front of a bestin. Okay, so let's take a look at the last paragraph and let's see what Ramban wrote. Right, so if you look at the last paragraph of the Beit Yosef, he says, and Ramban wrote, certainly l'chatchila we require 3, whether for circumcision or immersion, and if he converts entirely alone, he is not a convert even b'diavad. Rather, he's an absolute non-Jew, as Mishpat has written the Torah regarding him, but if he accepts upon himself before 3 to circumcise and immerse, and they inform him of some mitzvah is required, and he went and circumcised and immersed, not bifnei Beit Din, it is valid, and we do not disqualify his son. So it sounds like the position that the Beis Yosef attributes to the Rif and the Rambam is really the position of the Ramban. The position he cites from the Ramban. Okay, why does he say the Ramban is saying the same thing as the Rif and the Rambam? Because he has a Rashba. And the Rashba says that the Ramban wrote to defend the Rif. So he knows that there's a Rashba that says the Ramban is defending the Rif. He knows there's a Magid Mishnah that says the Rif and the Rambam say the same thing. So if the Ramban is defending the Rif, and the Rif and the Rambam say the same thing, then the Ramban must be saying the same thing as the Rambam. And therefore, right? And so if we assume the Ramban is correct in the Rif and the Rambam, that's how we emerge with the statement, the Rif and the Rambam say X. Okay, and I think that's how we got to the Shulchan Aruch, right? That even though the tour didn't mention the Rambam, but the Magid Mishnah said that the Rambam says the same thing as the Rif, and the Rashba says the Ramban says the same thing as the Rif. So A equals B, B equals C. Therefore, it's A equals B, A equals C. Therefore A equals B, something like that. Okay, so they're all identified. But now, right? So we have a perfectly reasonable understanding. There's Tosfot who says it works b'di'evid. We didn't even bother seeing that. We're going to grant him that. And then there are the Rif and the Rambam, as understood by the Ramban, who say that it works on a super b'diavad. Nobody thinks it doesn't work at all. Right? That's a reasonable understanding of halacha as it comes out. Just if it's a weird, weird halacha that the Ramban says. Okay, now we have to actually go back to the sugya. Where do we get this idea? It's b'diavad l'chatchila. Why can't we just have a straightforward halacha? You need bezdin. You don't need bezdin. Where all this come from? So, there are actually 5 sugyot that come into play, but I only translated 3 of them, and the 3 of them we can put into very short, it's a very short term. The first one is the story which says exactly what we said. It says that seems to say that if you go to mikveh for Nida, or if a man, you go to mikveh because of keri, because of a seminal emission, that works at least for your kids. Right? There are 3 stories in the Gemara. One of them seems to suggest that it works for you. 2 of them suggest it works for your kids. And it's not clear which version of how many of the stories each of the Rishonim has. Okay, that's the first piece of data. That's the one Shlomo Kluger was working with. Then there's a second statement. This is B. The second statement says that a convert, right, says that there was a time when somebody came, when a convert came, and they told him he had to wait till the next day to convert. And one of the reasons he had to wait is because there was no Beit Din of three present. And added to that is a statement Rabbi Yochanan says a convert requires three because the Torah says Mishpat Echad Yelachem, so conversion is just like Mishpat, it's just like civil law, and conversion requires a Beit Din of three. Okay? And that statement shows up in one other context where a man shows up and says, I converted privately, and we say to him, well, you know what, you say you convert, right? And he has a child already, and that child is claiming, and that child is acting Jewish. So we say, well, you know what, we believe you. You converted privately, so you're not Jewish. So you can't testify about that Jew over there. So he is Jewish, because who are you? It's a very interesting outcome. Right? What matters for our purpose is that a totally private conversion, it seems is totally invalid. We say to him, you are not Jewish, but your kid is. Which you can see how somebody might somehow get from there to a statement that there's a conversion that works for the child but not for the father. Yes?
What makes the guy not Jewish?
He didn't convert in front of Beit Din, L'chora.
How do we know? Because the guy, he looks like a Jew, he acts like a Jew. He tells us 10 years later he's really not Jewish.
Yes. He doesn't tell us. He says, I converted.
And he tells us why. He says why he's not Jewish. He says because he converted without a Beit Din.
Yes.
Who cares? Why does that make him not Jewish? I can't get up and say I'm not Jewish.
There is a sugya where someone basically says that.
Yes.
And we say, Namana Talif Sol.
That's a sugya.
That's a sugya.
The question is...
No, but like that's
the question is, could you say it if we had known that you were Jewish? You were not Jewish at one point. And when you started acting Jewish as a convert. So you might be able to declare, you know what, I was just faking. I think that.
But now I'm Jewish.
So you said that, but now what? That's because we assumed you had converted. And now it turns out that conversion...
I have a chazakah of being a Jew.
That's the whole question. We have a chazakah of the reyes, though, because we know that you were not Jewish at one point. So we go back to the beginning. That's what the Dian and the Rishonim is.
But I've been acting like a Jew. Why am I doing that? I'm not Jewish.
Why were you doing that? Because you like challenge.
Okay, but give me a chazakah of being
a Jew. No, not clear because you like chazakah. Not clear. Your kid who has never been known to us as not Jewish. That's one thing. But if you show up and just start acting Jewish, that doesn't necessarily give you a chazakah if we know that you were not Jewish previously. It's chazakah the other way. You're faking. Okay.
So, last gemara.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding. It doesn't seem like it's saying that it's a good conversion for the child, but rather that we just don't believe him.
That's true. It doesn't seem like it's saying that. Right? If I were reading this Gemara independently, I would say it had nothing to do with the weird position of the Ramban. But I'm just saying you could... Now at least we have a precedent in the Gemara of a case where we have two people, blood relatives, and even though it's talking about a male in that case, and everyone tries to figure out, so who cares, right? Why is there a contradiction between the father being not Jewish and the child being Jewish? We only care about the mother. We're going to bracket that because we're a gender-neutral culture. Well, we showed him to say, right, that really we don't, you know, it says male, but it doesn't make a difference. So we have a precedent for a case in which we treat the parent as Jewish and the kid is not, even though they should be mutually, those should be contradictory positions.
Just think about the lashon of the Gemara.
Yeah, I agree with you. Okay. I agree. I'm just pointing out that outcome-wise, you can see, right, you can suspect that perhaps somebody read this Gemara to get to the Ramban's position. Right? If you know that somebody ends up with a position recalling the Ramban's, and you know, and you're wondering, like, how did anybody, could everyone say something like that? And you know there is a Gemara which has this outcome, you can, right? You might ask yourself, boy, I wonder if somebody read this Gemara to get to that outcome. Yes, Roger.
It's a question on the son, whether he's Jewish or whether he can marry, or what is...
Whether he is completely Jewish. Up to and including marrying Jews, which is the highest level of Jewishness.
So the assumption is that the mother was Jewish.
No. Our assumption is that the, it would be the exact same thing if a woman showed up and said it.
So a technical example is given here, which is a man. The man is a questionable convert.
Yeah, but the man, We're only calling him a man because we slipped into habits of speech. It would be exactly the same if we're a woman.
Fine, but take the case of a man.
Yeah.
A non-Jewish man goes through whatever this process is and marries and has relations with a Jewish woman. Isn't the child automatically Jewish?
Yes, that's why that can't be the case, and therefore we have to say that we slipped and we talked about a man, but really we're talking about a woman. We just
really
do that in our case.
Okay, so this is only talking about the case of a woman.
Or we have to construct case. We have to say this goes according to the position that that the child of a non-Jewish man and a Jewish woman is a mamzer or something like that. And this says it's not the case. But there is that position in the Gemara. We don't paskin that way. But whenever we have something which sounds weird, we pull that position out.
Well, the Rif says Befeirush not like it.
So yes. We'll get to the Rif. Okay, but I want you to keep those three Gemaras in mind. Okay, I want you to keep those three Gemaras in mind. The Gemara which says go to mikveh for nida. Right, that counts. Gemara that says, nope, you can't convert without a bezin. And a Gemara which says that if you convert entirely with no one else present, you're not Jewish at all, but somehow your kid is. Whatever the logic of that is. Okay, now I want to read the riff inside. Okay, so the riff says the following. He quotes Gemara A. But he leaves, right, so he says, the servant of Rav Chiya bar Abba, why is the servant and what does it matter is, immersed a Gentile woman for the sake of wifehood, whatever that means. And Rav Yosef said, I can legitimate both her and her daughter. Her, like Rav Asi said, didn't she go to mikveh for Nida? And her daughter, Rav ben Levi, said we reject the position that a patrilineal is a mamzeret. Now there are two stories. There was somebody whom they used to call son of a Gentile woman, and Rav Asi said, why are you calling him that? She immersed for Nida. She's not a Gentile, apparently. Or, so what? She's Jewish anyway. And the same thing with a man. Okay, so he quotes our Gemara pretty much the way we have it. Now he says, Suga d'shmaita hachinhu, right? This is the halachic path of the tradition follows this sugya. Now you're going to tell me, v'ikashi l'chahid Rabbi Yochanan, you're going to tell me, how can we follow this Gemara? This Gemara isn't against an explicit statement. Rav Yochanan says that a ger requires a beitin, because it says mishpat. So how can you tell me that she went to mikveh for nida and that works? So he says, no problem. Lo kashiha, there's no problem. Right, b'kaim l'an hilchas, we hold like Rav Yochanan, because we always hold like statements of Rav Yochanan l'halacha. So this Gemara must be wrong. So he says, lo kashiha, that's no problem. Because Rav Asi and Rabbi Yeshua, the two stories we just read, they are only b'di'evid. Right? When we say that it counts when you go to mikveh for nida, that's only b'di'evid. And what does that mean? De'lo paslinan livrei. We don't invalidate the kid. That's what b'di'evid means. Ho'il v'taval l'shem kiryo. Since the father went to mikveh for nida. And presumably, or since the father went to mikveh for keri, or the mother went to mikveh for nida. So up till now, he is saying exactly what Ramban said he's going to say. Right? He says the solution to the contradiction is that the Gemara, which says it works, is talking b'diavad, which means that your kid is okay. But then he says, has one line that changes everything. And the one line that changes everything, he said, why? D'ilav yurahu, because if he were not a convert, lo hava tavil l'shem kiryo. If he were not a convert, he would not have gone to mikveh for his keri. So that, as right now Roger read ahead, that seems very, very strongly to suggest that it's not that because she went to mikveh for nida that she became a Jew, it's that the fact that she went to mikveh for nida is evidence that there must have been a prior valid conversion. Okay, so it sounds like the Rif is actually saying something entirely different than what was attributed to him by the Ramban. Or that then the Beis Yosef says the Ramban attributes to him. Right? Because the position the Shulchan Aruch Paskin's like is that immersion not in front of Beit Din works. But what the Rif says, if you have this right, this line, which says, right, because if he were not a convert, he would not have gone to Beit Din, it doesn't mean that the immersion works. It means the immersion is evidence of a different conversion that works. If you weren't really Jewish, why would he have gone to mikveh? Yes, Andy.
So when Rav Asi says back in the morning, he says, did she not immerse for nida? My first thought about that was, well, he's trying to legitimate her conversion in the process of her having done for nida. whereas what you're saying now is, no, maybe Rav Ossi was saying that, no, that was an indication that she felt she was already Jewish and that's why she...
That's right. And that's how, and I think it's clear that's how the Rif reads it, because you have that line, right? If you were not a convert, why would he have gone to mikveh? That's plainly evidentiary. Okay, but in case you say, okay, so that's a line in the Rif, maybe the Ramban read it a little differently. So now we have to look at the Rambam. So look at the Rambam on the bottom of the page. The Rambam says, if you have a woman whom we have seen practicing, right? Right, Giorit, I'm sorry, the word Giorit got cut off for you. So Giorit should renew a noheget b'darchei Yisrael tamid. You have a female convert, right, meaning someone who presents herself as a convert, who is constantly practicing Jewish ways. For example, she immerses for Nida. And she takes challah. Or there's a guy, and he immerses for Keri. Or he does one of the standard, you know, he puts on tefillin. So the Rambam says, hey, it's right. These are, he says, right, presumptively valid converts, even though there are no witnesses testifying as to whom they converted in the presence of. Right, so the Rambam is 100% clear. First of all, he says, Nida, right, he can prove to you it's not the immersion that makes it valid, because he doesn't care if she went to mikveh for Nida or if she took challah. All that matters is if you have a woman who presents herself as a convert who is behaving Jewish. So that is evidence there must have been a conversion. And then the Rambam says, but even so, right, even so, the Rambam says, if they come to marry, we don't let them marry until they bring witnesses or until they immerse in front of us. He doesn't tell you what happens once they marry, whether we legitimate the kids or not. But if the Rif and the Rambam are saying the same thing, then it's 100% clear what the Rif and the Rambam are saying. What they're saying is that people who keep halacha, right, have a right to be presumed that they went to mikveh in front of a beit din.
Except they can't marry a Jew,
right? Because we often have a higher standard of proof for marriage than anything else.
They marry somebody else who's presumptive.
That's an interesting question. And then maybe we'll treat the kids. Rambam doesn't say that about the kids.
So what if you treat them as a Jew? You give them aliyot.
Could very well be. You give them aliyot.
But the Rambam and Rif don't really explain the mechanism for how their actions are made that they're Jewish.
Why not? If they create a presumption, why are you crazy? What are you doing this for?
People like Jews, I don't know.
Okay, so that's an interesting question whether we would still apply this halacha in a world where there were some advantages to being from other ways. And do we live in such a world or not? Right? Or more, right, more seriously, the question is, do we apply this halacha in a world where there are lots of people who underwent conversions that they believed to be valid, but which we don't accept. Right? So it might be this doesn't apply nowadays because there's a, right, because we assume at that point everyone knew what the halachot of conversion were, and right away, but we might say, no, why would you be really frum if you didn't, right, if you didn't accept Orthodox standards in the first place? But the answer is yes, there are people like that. I know full well there are people like that. Right, who, you know, behave as perfectly, right, perfectly observant Orthodox Jews. Although they are aware, and I am aware, that the conversions they underwent would not, you know, if they came to Beit Din and asked us to write a certificate of Jewishness, it wouldn't hold up. Yes, sir.
Can we go back to the Rif for just a moment?
Sure.
He said, "De'ilav yirahu lo have a tava l'shem kiryo."
Yes.
If he went on a ger, he wouldn't have, he wouldn't have immersed for his carry.
Yeah.
We have a phrase that we use, ger sheni gayer
le'bilu le'atzma. Mm-hmm.
He's also called ger.
Yeah, so that's the word ger means someone who presents themselves as a convert, which is a long-term phrase. So we don't have, right, so we just cut it down to ger. Mm-hmm. Right, that happens all over Shas. Okay. That we use the word ger for somebody who hasn't actually converted, but for somebody who in some way is in the gerus process.
So why do we not read the here as something more like that?
If he were not in, if he did not have the intention of converting, but we describe this as immersion not for the sake of conversion.
That's no, but if you were not someone in the process of converting who has some sort of, who is in somehow called ger, then he wouldn't have done tevilah l'shem kiryo, and somehow that works any, I don't know.
Okay, it might be at the end you'll say that you're okay. If I asked you, which is it more likely to mean?
Probably
Okay. And now we know the Rambam, right? There's no way out of the Rambam.
No.
There's no way out of the Rambam. And yet, the Shulchan Aruch said, the Rif and the Rambam said the same thing, and sounded like what he said, the same thing he said was the Ramban, and not what I just said. So how did that happen? Okay. So, how did that happen? Well, remember, we said that the Shulchan Aruch suggests that the Rif and the Rambam both hold the position that immersion not in front of Beit Din actually works as an extreme bidyavad. It's not evidence. Right? Going to mikvah for nida is not evidence of a conversion. It actually constitutes a conversion. And that's the position the Shulchan Aruch attributes to the Rif and the Rambam. We saw that was the position of the Ramban, but not the but it seems not to be the position of either the Rif or the Rambam. So how did that happen? That the Beis Yosef, right, how did the Beis Yosef say... Now we saw that the Tur didn't even think it was the position of the Rambam. The Tur only thought it was the position of the Rif. So I think the answer to all this is that the Beis Yosef had a Rif, he had a Rambam, and he had a Magid Mishnah who quoted a Rambam. What didn't he have? He didn't have a Ramban. Now, what does the Ramban actually say? So if you go right, so now we don't have it translated, but I've highlighted the sections for you in the Ramban. So I just want you to look at the structural terms of the Ramban. So the first thing the Ramban does is he quotes Halachot Gedolot and says that's wrong. Now, first thing, it says, V'nichalei l'Rabbeinu HaGadol Zichrono Livracha. It seems to me, right, it's good, it seems proper to the Rif, the Rabbeinu HaGadol Zichrono Livracha is the Rif. We're on the page that's later, it's after 6. Chiddushi Ramban.
Page 8.
Okay, thank you. So the Chiddushi Ramban says the first bolded thing, he says, V'nichalei l'Rabbeinu HaGadol Zichrono Livracha. It seems fit for the Rif. That of Rav Yochanan is only lechatchila. They only require 3 lechatchila, meaning that we don't let him marry a Jewess, until he goes to mikvah in front of 3. What's his comment about that? The ein dvarav brurin. But I think that the Rif is unclear. I think the Rif is wrong. Why do I think the Rif is wrong? Because I don't understand how we can have Gemara C where we tell where we say that you're not believed to invalidate your kids. If the conversion really works, says the Ramban, it's not a question of belief. If we believe him that he converted between himself and converted privately, the kids are valid. That's what we just said, right? If you really take the position, if you take the position that the conversion works on a super bidyavad level, then he says, I don't understand why this should work. So what happens? The Ramban here clearly believes that the Rif believes what Avi said. Because what he says is, the Rif said that the kids are really valid. How can that be? That doesn't make sense for the Gemara. So now we know the Ramban really thought the Rif said what Avi said, not what I said. Okay? But he says, V'yesh lidchok, I have a cheap answer to that one. That maybe the guy who said I converted by myself and I never went to mikvah.
That disproves from our
program. No. Okay, now he says, I have a bigger question on this though. Right? Even though I can get out of that kosher on the Rif, I have a bigger question on the Rif. When he goes into Gemara D and he says, but you know what? There's a way to answer that problem. Okay, so where have we been so far? We said the Rif said this, which is what Avi said the Rif meant. We said, I'm not sure I agree with that. Yeah, I can put it back together again. But I've got a really big problem with it. There's a way of answering that problem. Now, that way of answering that problem could mean we stay with the Rif, or could mean he's developed his own position. I'm comfortable saying, which is what the Rashba said, that the Ramban really believes the Rif said that, and he agrees with the Rif. Okay, but now we turn the page. But the Rambam, he says, said something else entirely. And it seems like he's coming to explain this. V'divrei temahim, and they are ridiculous. And that's the end of it. He never comes back to the Rambam. If the Beis Yosef had the Ramban, he would have known that the Ramban was not explaining the Rambam. The Ramban was rejecting the Rambam. And therefore, you cannot say that the Ramban equals the Rif, and the Rif equals the Rambam. Therefore, the Ramban equals the Rif and the Rambam. Because the Ramban explicitly says, I am not agreeing with the Rambam. Okay, but the Beis Yosef didn't have the Chiddush Ramban. So this is an error. Now, the Ramban, the reason the Ramban says the Rambam doesn't agree with the Rif is that the Ramban knows that the Rambam thinks that the conversion doesn't work at all because going to mikveh for Nida only helps as evidence, not as reality. But he reads the Rif like Avi. Now, how do you read the Rif like Avi? So if you look at the Meiri, did I give you the Meiri on the next? Give you the Meiri? I think two pages later. The Meiri goes through it, and he says, he's explaining, he says, Gedolei HaPoskim, right? Gedolei HaPoskim is the Rif. And he goes through it all, and he says, in the boldest section, it seems, Mikol Makom Nirel Milashonam Shekachu Shekachu Lashonotam. Yeah, what we need is the underlined line. He says, this is in the Rif. Me'acher Shara'inu with Aviv Tovel L'Kirio, since we have seen his father immersed for his carry, Oet Imo Tovel Nidata, or his mother immersing for his Nidah, Machazikin Otam, we presume, Shekvar Nidgaru B'toch Shlosha. Or B'tnei Shlosha, they already immersed in front of three. So the Meiri clearly read the Rif, as we did, against Avi. And the Rif really does agree with the Rambam, and the Ramban really disagrees with both of them. Okay, but how did it happen that the Beis Yosef, and how did the Ramban think the Rif said this? How did the Ramban think the Rif said this? So I think if you look, you'll see that the Ramban never quotes that line, the Ilav Yurahu, lo havatavil l'shem kiryo. Now, why does he not quote that line of the Rif? So I have a totally crazy speculative theory. So you can all take a look. If we go back to the Rif, all right? So as we go back to the Rif, you'll see that I had that line, di lav girahu lo havatava l'shem kiryo. You see I have that bolded? Yeah? Okay. Anybody know, right, anyone want to tell me what the last three words of that line are that I just read? Tavah l'shem kiryo. Anybody want to tell me what the last words of the last three words of the line directly above are? Tavah l'shem kiryo. Everybody in the medieval period who interprets the Ramban, the Rif, the way I think is correct, has that line. Everybody in the medieval period who interprets the Ramban, interprets the Rif the way the Ramban does, is only quoting the Rif from the Ramban. So I think what happened is that there were two different editions of the Rif, one of which had that line, one of which skipped that line because of what's called a red homotoleaton, two consecutive lines ending with the same words, you tend to skip. So I think the addition of the Rif the Ramban had was missing that line. That generated a whole stream of interpretation of the Rif, which I think is incorrect. You can actually geographically say it. Everybody in Sfarad has that addition. Everybody in Provence has the addition which has that line. No. Provence. The Meiri and the Migdalos have the line, right? And the Ramban and the Rashba and all that whole tradition don't have that line.
But the Rambam has that line, though.
Rambam has excellent traditions from Spain.
Yeah, I don't know. It's much earlier. Right. So we could. I'll take the Dr. Soloveitchik line. No, right. Everyone in real Andalusia, right, has the line when you get to, right. When you get to right, but Catalonia.
Right. Spain doesn't, but
yes. All right, that's a wild speculation. What I can say is that you have a machloket rishonim as to how to understand the Rif. There's one line that seems to me dispositive. Nobody who interprets it the other way in the medieval period quotes that line, right? And the people who interpret it the other way do quote that line. That's smoke. Right. By the 16th century, there's a tshuva of the Maharshach in which somebody suggests Avi's interpretation of the Rif, and the Maharshach says, "What? Are you nuts? How could you possibly read it that way?" But once you know that, right, once you have a tradition that the Ramban reads it that way, and you don't know that there's a Girsa issue, so Avi's reading will become plausible. So this is what I think happened. Now the question is, what do we do with halacha? What I think happened is that there was an original position of the Rif in the Rambam. The position of the Rif was subject to a scribal error which led to a tradition in the Ramban. Then the Ramban got right, the Ramban did not make it all the way to the Beis Yosef. So now the Beis Yosef has the Ramban understanding the Rif one way. He has the Magid Mishnah who suggests that the Rif and the Rambam say the same thing. He doesn't know that the Ramban explicitly rejects the Rambam. And so the Beis Yosef and the Shulchan Aruch claims that the Rif and the Rambam both say what the Ramban says, even though the Ramban explicitly rejects this, and it's not pshat in either the Rambam or the Rif. Right, so we want to be commonly say the Beis Yosef claims this is the position of the Beis Yosef and the Rambam as the Ramban tells us, and it's not really the position of the Ramban doesn't say it's the Rambam, and neither the Rambam nor the Rif said it. Now, what does that mean for us, l'halacha? Do we say, well, the Shulchan Aruch quotes these two positions, and according to the Shulchan Aruch, everybody says it's okay, at least B'divya Adi? Do we say, hang on a sec, but the Shulchan Aruch left out, right? Shulchan Aruch is based on a series of errors in the transmission. Yes, Judah?
Actually, that matters, though, because Rambam and Rif are perfectly fine posting, so Rambam and Rif said exactly what he...
No, the Rambam and Rif don't say it. The Rambam and Rif say it's only evidentiary, and the Rambam and Rif say, really, an immersion shalom b'fnei beit din is completely invalid.
As opposed to being
super b'diavad.
The Rambam
and the Rif really say that conversion shalom b'fnei beit din doesn't work at all. But the Ramban had a girsa in the Rif, which made him think that it works as a super b'diavad. The Beis Yosef had a version of the Ramban, which made him think the Ramban was saying that about the Rambam also.
Right, but so that just makes the case stronger against the Poskim who recently came out saying that.
Yes, it does make the case stronger against them, if you want, but you can also say, look, who cares about what the real pshat in the Rif and the Rambam is? Besides, who just made that up? It's a speculative emendation. It's a theory of transmission. The Beis Yosef said, that's what the Rif and the Rambam say. They said the other position is a Shita Dechuya completely. Okay. We're going to run out of time soon, so I should probably do two other things, right? I wanted two other things, because this is not the only thing that happens in this course of this thing. All right, so the next thing that comes up is, what does Tosfot really say? What does Tosfot really say? So Tosfot quotes, I'm going to have to do this outside. Tosfot quotes, Tosfot starts with the same question, where he says, but the Gemara says that it works for Nida, how can you do that? But the Gemara says that you need three. And Tosfot's answer is, well, maybe you only need three lichatchila and not bidiavad. That's one answer of Tosfot. And Tosfot gives a second answer. Maybe you only need three for Kabbalat HaMitzvot and not for immersion. Then Tosfot puts the two answers together. Maybe you need a Beit Din Lichatchila for immersion and B'dievet for Kabbalat HaMitzvot. Alright, and that's the outcome of the position of Tosfot, is that, right, and that's how we get to the position of the Shulchan Aruch quotes. Right, Tosfot puts these two answers together. Right, how do you resolve the contradiction? The answer is that everybody agrees we need Beit Din Lichatchila for immersion. But some people, right, but the resolution of the sugya is and everybody agrees you need Beit Din B'di'evit for something, but the something is not immersion. Okay, we could have a much longer share. You can look at my Web Yeshiva class where we talk about how that happened, how those two positions got combined and whether they ever existed independently. Then Tosfos comes up with a totally different position. Tosfos says, you know what, and maybe this is a totally different answer. Maybe the answer is, and this is a totally clever move, Tosfos says, maybe Rav Asi said, right, so somebody comes and says, hey, that guy's mother isn't Jewish. And Rav Asi says, what are you talking about? Didn't her mother go to mikveh? What does that assume? Everyone knows her mother goes to mikveh. So Tosfot says, maybe the correct answer is, of course you have to go to Beit Din, you have to go to mikveh in front of Beit Din, but why do you have to go to mikveh in front of Beit Din? You have to go to mikveh in front of Beit Din because Beit Din has to know that you went to mikveh. Or maybe more radically, because Beit Din serves as the representative of the Jewish community, and the Jewish community has to know. But here everyone knew. Here everyone knew. So that's good enough. If you go to mikveh in a way that, right, that everyone knows that she went to mikveh, and I think that's a better answer, because we don't even know who the Beit Din is who supposedly knew. We don't know, right? Or Rav Asi, he turns around and he says, look, everyone knows she went to mikveh. So it tells us this total radical move. And he says, you know what? Really, of course we require a Beit Din, but we only require a Beit Din when there will otherwise not be universal knowledge. Okay, that's a great way out. The problem is that Tosfot rejects this. Tosfot says this is wrong. It's wrong for a simple reason, Tosfot says, is because it doesn't solve the problem. You know what? Okay. She went to mikveh, it's as if she went to mikveh in front of Beit Din, for Nida. But when do you go to mikveh for Nida? at night. I can't solve that problem by saying that everyone knew. It still took place at night. Can't say it's as if it was in front of Beit Din. So what? If Beit Din had been standing there, it would still have been at night. So Tosfos says this is wrong. But now let's be careful. Does Tosfos say this is wrong because it's wrong halachically? Or does he say it's wrong because it doesn't answer the question? Maybe it's only wrong because it doesn't answer the question. It doesn't solve the contradiction. But in principle, Tosfos still agrees that if you could find a circumstance where someone meant to mikveh during the day in a way that it would be as if Beit Din was present even though they were not, maybe that would work anyway. Now the problem is that the Shulchan Aruch never quotes this. Right? This position never makes it into the Shulchan Aruch. He only quotes the first position of Tosfos. But maybe the reason the Shulchan Aruch never quotes it is because this is not a law in mikveh. This is a general rule about things taking place in front of Beit Din. And he didn't quote it here because, and as a solution to the Geiris question, it didn't work. But maybe Tosfos holds in principle that whenever you require something to happen b'fnei Beit Din, having it happen in a way where the Beit Din can't be certain anyway is good enough. So maybe, right? And so on the one hand, this is a position not quoted at all in Shulchan Aruch. On the other hand, it's a position that maybe everyone agrees with. Because it doesn't depend, right? Because you can accept any, you can say that Beit Din is absolutely necessary. Just we have it. So now the whole conversation, everything we did so far can be totally irrelevant if we just take that move. The only issue is we're quoting a position that isn't in Shulchan Aruch. We have to explain why it's not in Shulchan Aruch. So that was another approach being taken. Yes, Elliot?
It doesn't really work with the idea of Talmidei Chachamim that you begin with Beit Din, and that they have to develop Bifnei Ham. There's sort of like some idea that they know what's going on and that seeing what's going on.
No, seeing is a big word. And knowing is... Right, so Rav Moshe uses this idea in a number of places. Right, in general, Rav Moshe is fond of the idea that there are certain, that in Umdana de Muchach, right, certain knowledge is equivalent to testimony. So in one tshuva, which he seems to contradict in two earlier tshuva, in one tshuva written, which is the last thing I have to think, written, I believe, through Rabbi Stephen Dworkin, who was, I believe, was he president of the RCA for years? He taught the first year rabbinics course in YU Smicha. That was a very sweet man. So he has this tshuva about a reality which I suspect happened often, which is that you have mikvot, that there's really only room for one person, only room for the dayanim to be there single file, because the entrance is so narrow. And so only the first dayan can see anything. So the Rabbi Dworkin wrote to him and said, what do we do? We just did this conversion, and we walked out, and the last two dayanim said, I didn't see anything, I couldn't see anything, all I saw was your back. Does that work? So Rav Moshe marshals a whole set of arguments saying, sure, that works. What are you worried about? The last one of which is he pulls out this Tosfot. But I would suggest that there's another way to do it, which Rav Moshe also points out, who says that testimony requires seeing, right? So famously, he says that you're allowed to testify b'fanai nechtam, at least somebody can, if all you heard was, in terms of a divorce, if all you heard was the scratching of the quill. So Rav Moshe says, well, obviously hearing is good enough, so maybe you heard the splash. That's where we get that from. Right? So all the Beit Din has to do is hear the splash. They don't actually... And I wonder what the word bifnehem actually means. So at least one place, for example, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says that you could blow shofar bifnei Beit Din in Rosh Hashanah that came out on Shabbat. And on at least one year, somebody testifies, so many private people were blowing shofar on Shabbat in Beit Din that you couldn't hear yourself think. Now, was Beit Din looking at all of them? Yeah, so many people blowing, right? Beit Din probably going like this. So it might be that Bifnehem means in their presence, as I forget who translated at the very beginning, and not in their sight. And that you can construct all sorts of ways. For example, we have to figure out what presence means. I thought of perhaps one-way glass. So the convert can see the Beit Din, but not vice versa. Because it's still in their presence, right? Maybe the presence is they have to have the atmosphere of being in front of Beit Din. It doesn't matter what the Beit Din sees. There are other ways of doing it. What I want to end up saying is I think that there are enough ways, b'deavad, right, in which you can say, right, regardless of how you interpret the Rishonim and what choices you make among the Rishonim, that at the end of the day, and this happens often, if you go through, you know, endless hours of going through the basic sugya, and it turns out that at the end what you really need is just a chap. Right? So by the way, here's a way to evade the whole halachic conversation. My sense is that although the formal halachic conversation has revolved entirely around, and it's a lot of fun, about whether in fact you're allowed to lichatchila adopt the position of Tosfot against the Rif and the Rambam, and whether that's okay because even the Rif and the Rambam would agree at some level it's b'diavad. And can we say that because of a Rifanoi situation it's a shas et chak, so you can turn a b'diavad into lichatchila, that probably the more productive way to create a universally recognized process that does, if you think it's desirable for the Beit Din to have, for there to be a universally recognized process in which the Beit Din doesn't have to be physically, doesn't have to see anything, then probably the way to do it is to adopt strategies like Rav Moshe's, and what I'm suggesting is to redefine Bifnehem in ways that don't require sight lines. And that's what I think the halacha should, right, the halacha should be in the end. Until that happens, I still think that probably it's unwise for people to take women to the mikveh without the Beit Din being present, without being directly present, just because you're setting yourself up for issues, especially if you're doing it explicitly, and you know, if you're playing chicken, right? There's a group of people who said, if you do that, we're going to declare it invalid. And you say, how? We're going to do it anyway. I don't believe you're going to declare it invalid. Believe me, they'll declare it invalid. Right? That's what happened in Israel, right? Where people yelled at Rabbi Sherman for retroactively invalidating conversions, but he didn't really retroactively invalidate conversions. He got up and he said, if you do this, I don't care how many you do, I'm going to invalidate them. And they said, you don't really mean that. And they went ahead and converted thousands of people in the way he said he would invalidate for the next 5 years or so. And then he finally got the case. And he said, you know what? I really meant it. So I'm not a big fan of calling bluffs when issues like this are at stake. But I think that in the end, that it would be a good idea not to stand up to that bluff, because I think b'di'avad it really should work. In some way, even though l'chatchila, I think it is a poor idea. I should say the practice of our Beit Din is what we call the floating poncho, where there's the entire surface of the water is covered with a neck hole. The woman or the man, if he wants, is in the water with only her head visible. She goes under the water. The Beit Din comes in and sees that there is nothing above the water. And so there's no sight line. The one time that this made me uncomfortable, which I think is worth thinking about, was a woman who was married, had previously considered herself Jewish, which is often the case in such conversions, and perhaps she was, right? Because it's the whole issue. We do lots of reconversions now, if there's any doubt at all, even if there isn't any doubt, we might do it just because somebody else might raise a doubt, even if there's no doubt in our minds. So here we have a woman who covers her hair. And you're in the mikveh, and so all that we're covering the rest of her body, but her head's still above water, her hair's still above water, and that was really uncomfortable. So that seemed and even though we come in after, still, right? There was no way to, if you really see hair covering as a tzniyus issue, so there's no way to avoid that, and I think that's a good test case for people to consider, because it doesn't happen that happens not so rarely. And that's a case where all the other machinations in the world aren't going to help solve people's discomfort at exposing a part of themselves that they would not ordinarily expose to men they're not married to. So I think it's valuable to continue the conversation and see if we can develop a consensus method. I say I have the one idea, which is logistically complicated, which is one-way glass.
Blindfolds.
Thought about blindfolds also, but I think that there's a certain element. The rabbis have to have dignity too. Right, and walking in blindfolded doesn't comport with my idea. Also, there's the health risk. So you're coming near a body of water. it seems to me to violate other Isurim. I think we need to have I think that the RCA guidelines ask for the poskim left unnamed to readdress the question to some extent. I think it's worth it having the conversation again. Although I think that now, even though I know people are doing it, and I'm not trying to bluff them, And I'm saying in the end, you know, I think there are enough ways to kosher it that people should not really, people shouldn't play games with other people, with other people's lives. But I don't think it's wise to do it, and I don't believe that there is no other, if there is no way of doing it that doesn't, right, that isn't as comfortable. Although I think the data on the RCA survey is very interesting about how many, right, how many, about what percentage of women felt uncomfortable the way it's done. I can say the only RCA conversion I ever, of a woman I ever participated in, she wore a robe, a loose, that's what the Manhattan Basin does, a loose robe in the water. So I'm not quite sure why that's such a big deal. I think that when we analyze it in the end, we're going to discover that, which I think some people have done, it has often a lot less to do with sexuality and more to do with power. And the problem with that is that gayness inherently is a power thing. It's not. It's really unrelated to gender, and you know, except insofar as gender in men and women, you know, always accentuates power issues. So yeah, it's not clear to me that we're solving the right problem often, or that, you know, and at some point we have to say, you know what, gayness is supposed to be a power thing to a certain degree. Right? There's no, you know, it's there's no way to make it less of a power issue than an immigration hearing, which is fundamentally what it is. Right. So I think that in that conversation in those terms would be much more useful. I think it's very valuable, but halakhically, so I hope you get, you know, on the one level you get a lot of the fun theory about trying to figure out what do we do halakhically. And this happens all the time, that our halakha is based on the Shulchan Aruch is based on the Beis Yosef. The authority of the Beit Yosef is in principle based on the premise that he had everything we had and more, and it turns out not to be so, that we had everything he had and more. And not only that, with the extra things we have, we can discover that there are things which are objectively, it's not a question of kavod, objectively, we have information he didn't have. There's no way that if he had the Chiddushei Ramban that we had, there's no way he could have thought that that what the Ramban said about the Rif is what the Rambam held. Right? There's no way he could have thought there would have been obvious Ramban, because the Ramban explicitly denies it. Right? So what do you do, halachically? Right? Do you just say, well, you know, Siyata Dishmaya, we got the halachas we did, and so the other stuff, right? I haven't even begun to talk about the literally hundreds of Rishonim who have different positions that don't make it into the Shulchan Aruch because he didn't have them on this issue. So I think that's a really broad question worth thinking about. Okay, yes, Andy.
Just practically back to the first source, letter B, says that so the wooden planks are up her neck, the judges are outside.
And then she immerses in front of them.
What's that?
And then she immerses in front of them.
Well, after she immerses. What's she doing is she's placed in the water for her neck. It's not immersion.
Listening.
What kind of herself up? Women place her in the water up for her neck. It's not immersion?
No, because in immersion you have to get your head underwater.
Well, she's not completely.
She has to be able to hear. Well, we do this, right? The woman's in the water. And we're outside the room, and we're shouting, do you agree to keep Shabbat? Do you deny Jesus entirely? Whatever the standard list of questions that you're supposed to ask are. Right, we've done that. It's kind of awkward. That's one of the suggestions in the RCA guidelines, is perhaps we could, be less scripted for people who never were, you know, who never had any Christian identity. So that question seems a little awkward, which we are good at. If people never had a Jewish answer, I don't think we ask that question. And also, just it's really awkward answering serious questions in the water to disembodied voices. On the other hand, it's worse to embodied voices. So we haven't quite found a way out of that.
But presumably, the reason why she's up to her neck is so that, assuming the water is not clear, right?
Well, no, it could be that, or it could, well, but that could be, water's not clear, and so her own issue is she's learning Torah, right, to what degree, so you shouldn't be learning Torah, right, so that's the whole Gemara, right, whether you can recite Kriyat Shema, right, so that might be the, you know, question of when you make a bracha on the mikvah, right, it might not be for the Dayanim, it might be for herself.
But he's standing, the male equivalent is standing, so I don't know if that.
Male equivalent is standing, yeah, but that might be, despite Rabbi Katz's recent shiva about breastfeeding. Right, it might be that. Okay. Right, it might be the issue is different for men and women. Yes.
I have a suggestion based. There's a related Tom in Ketubah, where what he does is he is willing to mix together a chazakah based on previous knowledge with chazakot of what we believe reality to be, where he says that we know that a woman used to be married to someone else, but we also believe that when women remarry, they check very carefully, and so therefore her previous chazakah relating to her previous status as a married woman becomes weaker due to this other chazakah about what we believe current reality to be.
Okay, so that'll get us to believe that she is Jewish. It won't get her to be Jewish.
Well, I'm suggesting that in the Ramban and the Rif, what's going on is that her behavior as a Jewish person weakens her previous chazakah of being non-Jewish.
Could be. I don't find that. You know, how that only works for her kid, I don't know. All right. Thank you guys so much. This has been a long night, and I love having a community that's willing to stay, you know, to listen to really complicated shurim late at night. Thank you for coming out, and hopefully we'll see you next week. If you want to stay and ask questions, that's fine, but I don't want to hold